Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 117 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, great to see you again.
Good to see you, Jason. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, so I figured one of the things that I wanted to start off with was maybe all the government attacks on crypto, because there seems to be a lot of them. The first one being, and I don't know how much you pay attention to this, but the Samurai wallet, the two guys that started that were just arrested or theoretically arrested. One's living in Portugal right now, so they're trying to extradite him and get him back. But it's pretty much a mixer like Tornado Cash that is trying to keep your crypto transactions anonymous. So once again, this kind of falls into the same bucket as what Tornado Cash did, where code is free speech and it's a little crazy that it's kind of happening. At the same time, theoretically, the government has said they're coming after Mixer, so it's not too surprising. Not that I agree with that, but since they're saying out of the 2 billion in transactions, 100 million of it or something like that, they blamed on Silk Road, which happened 10 plus years ago at this point.
Oh, yeah, long time ago.
Yeah, so it's, I think, kind of frustrating that that's happening, but it is something to pay attention to. And I think even the FBI has come out and said, you should not be using any service that is not, I guess, approved by the U.S. government as a money services company. And they gave like a link to go look that up. But at the end of the day, who's going to go look that up?
Nobody. Nobody knows what if they're doing something wrong or not. You know, the way they're not doing regulations, companies can pop up, do stuff, and then before they know it, they're way off sides as far as regulators are concerned. So I think this is low-hanging fruit for like the national security and anti-terrorism, mantra that the government seems to pound, or parts of the government seems to pound that drum. And so, yeah, it's certainly frustrating from this side of it, but it's tough to justify, we need to be able to mix coins. Why would you need to do that if everything's on the up and up? You know, it's kind of a tough side to defend. But at the same time, I mean, if you go through this, you know, the Bitcoin are traceable, right? So if you're doing transactions left and right, it would be nice to just be like, you know what, I need to kind of clean these up just to make sure that some of them weren't a part of something nefarious. And then the government has a reason to come after me for ill-gotten Bitcoin that were involved in some crime. So there is benefit to kind of putting it through. It's not like if you have US dollars and they were $1 million were used in a terrorist attack, and if somehow or another you ended up with a couple hundred of those dollar bills, there's no way that they could trace that. But on the Bitcoin side, that's not the case. So it would be nice to be able to periodically just cleanse your, like, wash your money. Not that you did anything wrong, but just because you didn't do anything wrong. So, you know, it's a tough, that's kind of a tough sell if people are saying that, you know, this is going to result in the death of people, and, you know, your desire to filter the Bitcoin that you've got so that it's not tied to anything. I don't know that that's a good argument from against people that are in power.
Well, I guess the way that I look at this is it starts to encroach on what the First Amendment of free speech, and then the Fourth Amendment of kind of protecting your privacy.
Search and seizure.
Yeah. So it's a little frustrating that it's happening, and I'll probably come back to this in a second, but I wanted to make sure we talked about this before we talked about another thing. The other big thing that is kind of crazy from the government is the SEC is suing more people. Shocker. So they went after, or they're going after MetaMask, which is probably the largest Ethereum wallet. And Consensus, who is the owner of MetaMask, has turned around and sued the SEC. And I think Coinbase and Uniswap have kind of come out and said, you're doing great. Thanks for doing this, because the SEC is a pain in the ass. And they're just trying to do all this regulation by enforcement without actually giving any rules. So they're going after Uniswap, they're going after Coinbase. It seems to be everybody out there is in some sort of trial almost with the SEC, although this one, to determine whether or not Ethereum is a security, is theoretically going to take years for it to happen. And Gary Gensler has kind of come out and said he would much rather have the courts determine whether Ethereum is a security rather than him make a decision. So it's just frustrating, right? The SEC is there to protect you theoretically, and that they don't do anything. They don't want to say anything about it at all. So it's really frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the reactivity versus being proactive. The problems in Congress with that, where they just allow bills to not get passed until there's a debt ceiling crisis, and then they stuff everything into an omnibus bill. It's almost the same on the SEC side now. It's like contagious, and the regulators aren't going to do anything because, I mean, maybe they feel like it hurts their ability to keep their job and retain their appointments. I don't know why else you wouldn't just do your job. You know, it's like, all right, hey, our mission is to protect retail. We're kind of above and beyond anything, and we let retail get sucked into all these problems, and then we come over the top and sue them and find the bad actors, even if they're not bad actors in theory. They're just acting, and the market is saying there's a demand for what they're doing. So it's getting old. The thing is, this isn't a winning strategy for the SEC if they really want to stifle this stuff, because there's too many tech entrepreneurs. They're just going to keep trying stuff until there's some rules built. And so it seems like the SEC's just acting as a slow moving incumbent government regulator, and they're not even considering what they're up against, which is, you know, 20,000 geniuses trying to figure out ways to build companies. So that, to me, it's a loser move for the SEC, but they've been doing loser moves for quite a while.
Well, and we've been talking about Ethereum ETFs, and I guess everybody was thinking the possibility of them getting approved in May of this year, which is literally around the corner, is pretty much not going to happen, right? If it happened in 2025, that would be amazing at this point, just with the amount of time it's going to take for this to be debated in court. So, I mean, maybe 2026, and by that time, shoot, the rest of the world is going to have it at this point. So, I mean, we've talked about the U.S. in the past about being the one that is leading innovation around the world, and that's what's kept the U.S. above everybody else. And we're not trending that way. I mean, we're trending the opposite. I mean, we still have a lot of smart people, but our government won't let us do anything or provide any regulations. So it's going other places, and other places are jumping on the bandwagon to be the first to this. And yeah, it's kind of sad.
Yeah. And not to kind of blow that up into the macro world, but you know, we got an inflation problem and a debt problem, and the only good way to get out of those problems without creating more problems is to be innovative and grow the economy faster than the debt. Well, if you're putting all these things in place that refuse to grow the economy in one of the more innovative areas, right? I mean, AI, crypto, electric vehicles, kind of those are seem to be kind of the three biggest growth areas. And I mean, yeah, we're not celebrating Tesla, which is the biggest electric vehicle company in the world that basically changed the game. Like Elon doesn't get invited to any of that stuff. You got AI's kind of, they're back and forth. It seems like they're having meetings to determine what regulations necessary, but the government and the whole big tech industry seems to work together pretty well. And so I think they seem to have better lobbyists than crypto. So that the AI thing seems to be moving forward okay, but there's a chance that really impacts productivity and employment. So it may not be the old school innovation and growth industry that helps fight inflation and boost the economy. And so, you know, these crypto things, which we talk about it almost every week, you bring up coins I've never heard of. And I'm like, it doesn't seem like an idea that needs to be stopped immediately before it gets off the ground. You know, it's like, let's see what happens. Let's see where it goes. This is why people invest, because the returns are asymmetric. So let them try, see where it goes. If it fails, it fails. If it succeeds, great. There's a new use for something, or it'll be doing something better than what we currently have. And so for me, you know, if they're going to regulate crypto into the ground, whether it's Bitcoin or crypto, it's not a successful strategy to get this thing turned around. So, I mean, it really is, from a macro standpoint, they're just putting all their eggs in the Treasury and the Fed basket, and that we can somehow avoid math getting us into trouble, and we can keep, you know, racking up debt, printing money, and everybody gets rich. I would think it makes more sense for people to get rich and for some people to make money by building companies that are useful, and for other people to save money by using those companies because they're better and more efficient than what we're using today. That's old school thinking, but it seems to work over time. So anyway, I'm just tired of loser moves, man. Like, it's time to do stuff that's going to actually work.
Yeah, with AI, they're able to somewhat regulate NVIDIA and say, don't give China the fastest AI chips, right? Which is fine. I understand why they're doing that, but it's, hey, we want to control this. With crypto, it's not that way. You can't say, oh, don't do this in the US, and then no one else is going to do it, because it's going to go to a different country and people are going to do it, and the US is going to be left behind. And I think that's kind of my frustration with all this. And now the other thing is, I don't know if you saw the new IRS form that is pending. I think it's the 1099-DA, but for the most part, it almost looks like it's trying to kill DeFi. So what they're going to do is require you to include all of your self-custodial wallet addresses, is what they're looking to do. So, and this is just crazy, right? That they're even looking at this. But if this happens, of course, it's going to go to the courts and it's going to take years, but they're talking about rolling it out next year, right? So it's amazing to me how much we kind of go back to the privacy piece of this, where theoretically the US was founded on privacy and being able to kind of not have anybody take your stuff at any time. And we're kind of doing a 180 from that and saying, we want access to all of your information at all times. And we can deem whether or not you're a security risk without actually going to court, and just say you're a security risk, and then you got to prove otherwise. So it's you're guilty until proven innocent, not innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah. So I did not see this new IRS form where you have to disclose all your self custodial wallet addresses. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you're self-custodial. So, like,
if this means that whoever came up with this has no idea, has never done a second worth of research, because all you'd have to do is spend a couple dollars to get a whole bunch of Dogecoin or a whole bunch of anything. Honestly, they would create a free token that would just create addresses. And then it would auto-populate, and then everybody that wanted to could submit 500,000 addresses. And then what is the IRS going to do? Track them all? Like, I mean, my experience with IRS stuff is most of it's submitted via paper. So if you're going to go through the trouble to create 50,000 addresses for yourself, you're definitely going to go through the trouble of printing it out on paper and mailing it to them. So then they're going to have to type it in. Like, this is beyond never going to work. Like, this, anybody that's ever gotten into crypto, that's ever met anybody, I mean, as soon as things, I mean, we got people donating sats to Bitcoin ETFs once they publish their address. They would definitely do this, right? There's no way to defend that. Like, if you want every one of my self-custody wallet addresses, I can give you as many as you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, I think their goal is they think that there's all this DeFi happening. Oh, and there's always a lot of DeFi happening, right? But they don't want DeFi to happen, right? Because it takes it away from the central banks and they lose control. So this is one of those ways that they're kind of fighting back on losing control. And shoot, we're seeing it in Nigeria, blaming crypto. Now it's getting to the point almost where the US is trying to say crypto is the problem. Not because we can't balance a budget and we just print money to oblivion. It's crypto's fault.
Oh, yeah. Let's circle back to it's going to be crypto's fault on another topic. But before we go there, speaking of stupid things the government says, I don't know if you saw Biden's proposed change to the capital gains tax.
No.
So what I read, it was two parts. One, the capital gains upper limit would be like 44%. So anything over $1 million or $1 million earner would be in the 44% tax bracket for capital gains, which that's real bad from an investment standpoint, right? Like, I mean, that's not good. People could work around it. You know, you could capture losses. That one's not the dumbest. It's real dumb, but it's not the dumbest. The other one was for any entities over 100 million, there would be a 25% unrealized gains tax, which is insane to consider. There's so, like, you would kill big tech, or you would kill startups.
Yeah.
Right. There's no chance. Private equity and venture capital would just be done. What are you going to do? You got a company worth $200 million and you have to sell 25% of it in order to survive, in order to just pay the taxes. So now who's going to invest in that? It's such a bad idea for it actually to be written down and then sent out and then other people can read it. It almost seemed fake. Like Elizabeth Warren had a fake thing that hit Twitter a couple weeks ago that was like a $3,000 limit for self-reporting Bitcoin and then a 1% wealth tax over $500,000. But it was like, it turned out to be like a fake thing that somebody sent out as a joke. But this one's real, but it's way dumber than the fake one. I mean, it's just, I'm tired of the government doing things that are dumber and dumber. You know what I mean? So at some point, the pendulum's got to swing back and we got to get somebody in control that can think past, you know, the next 5 minutes.
And it's like, you're doing this now right before election. Like, how do you think this is going to help you win the election? Like,
this is, you know, if it only attacks people over $1 million a year or $100 million in wealth, then there's a whole bunch of people that think that those people should be paying everything they got. So I think that it could be like a thing to get votes from the bottom 50%. But I mean, anybody that's gone to college that's not like just heavy left, money doesn't matter, numbers don't matter, you know, everything is a social problem. You know, people that don't actually kind of, I mean, 1 second of thinking about the implications of this eliminates it. And so I think it's just trying to prey on the bottom 50% and see if they can squeeze some votes. But like, you really want to tick off your biggest donors? Like, that doesn't seem like a smart idea either. So I don't know, man. I don't know what they're doing up there. It doesn't seem smart. But I mean, I just heard of the self-custody wallet address disclosure thing that you brought up. And immediately I'm like, there's probably 1,000 people in crypto that would love to send them 10,000 addresses each in a big stack of, you know, they'd pay the $20 to ship the stack of paper to them. You know what I'm saying? That's 10, they're going to have to write down by hand 10 million addresses that are 32 characters long of numbers and lower and upper case letters. Like that's, they need 87,000 more IRS agents just to process all the crypto addresses. So dumb.
Yeah, it is crazy. And I know we talked a little bit about the stablecoins and the legislation going on there. So there's the one we talked about from Cynthia Loomis and the lady in
Hildebrand,
New York. Hildebrand, yeah. So I've been reading more about that. And of course, their big goal has been to make sure we support the dual banking system that's been in place for a long time, which sounds great. Right. But there's a couple of issues that have kind of come up from all of that. And one of the issues being that the Fed can veto any tries to come up with their own stablecoin. So it's pretty much they're able to eliminate any of their competition, which doesn't make sense. Usually it's been the state and the Fed can kind of both have powers. And now they're putting it all in the Fed. And then they're also limiting it to you can't have more than 10 billion. Right. So which is tiny compared to the amount of money that we are printing, which is in the trillions, right? So
yeah, we're borrowing like $1 trillion every few months now.
Yeah. So, it's exciting to hear that we're trying to pass regulation. It's just frustrating to hear that we're putting stuff in there that doesn't actually help with innovation and creating a new application for all this, which is frustrating too.
Yeah, I mean, $10 billion is a real low bar, man. Like Elon Musk bought Twitter for $44 billion. Like, he raised the money real quick and put in some of his own. 10 billion is a low bar for something like that. But it feels like, oh, whatever, man. They can do whatever they want. They're gonna have to fight a whole bunch of battles, especially if they're interoperable. If you've got stable coins that can cross chains, then it would be like, okay, yeah, we have 1,000 stable coins that are all interoperable, and they're all at $9 billion. And it just works.
Yeah. I mean, well, just look at Tether. Tether is 110 billion in market cap, right? So I don't know what they're going to have to do to that one if they think that one is a problem. But what's interesting with Tether is they just created 4 new divisions inside their company. I don't know if you've heard much about this. So they invested $200 million, which is a decent amount, into a brain computer interface company called BlackRock Neurotech, which has no connection to BlackRock at all. They just use the name because it probably gets them way more attention.
Yeah.
And so they're doing this. So the 4 divisions they've created is data, finance, power, and education, right? So I think the data is where this falls. Finance is where the stablecoin stuff falls into. Power is actually related to Bitcoin mining infrastructure. And then education, I'm still not 100% sure what that is, but just educating people, I guess, on how to use crypto, maybe? I don't know. So it's interesting that this huge stablecoin company is trying to be not just a stablecoin company. And yeah, it's wild out there right now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much I like Tether coming up with like a Neuralink brain interface with things. But you know, 200 million Tether is like 2 weeks of net earnings. So, I mean, it sounds like a lot, but for them, that's a reasonable amount of money to put into to kind of create some business units and things like that. I mean, they're so flush with cash, they got to do something. So I don't know, man. That one's a little bit in left field. I'd have to think a little bit more on that.
Yeah, and then we've talked about Mica in the past, right, and over in Europe, and all of that starts in June. So we're a couple months away from that. What's crazy is I think they're getting about 18 months to be grandfathered in to get everything up and running. So there are quite a handful of countries that are nowhere near being prepared to handle the whole MiCA legislation and regulation. And they expect to take all 18 months. I think whoever the MiCA group is tried to reduce it down to 12 months, but there's a handful of countries that think it's going to take them every bit of 18 months. And then they've also done, I think they just approved a bill that has to do with anti-money laundering. So I guess that's good, right? I mean, I don't know why that wasn't really included in it from the beginning, because that seemed to be the whole reason for all this regulation anyway, is the KYC and the AML stuff. So why this is just happening and now it's going to take a couple of years for it to get kind of rolled into MiCA is still kind of amazing to me.
Yeah. The speed at which government moves compared to the speed at which Bitcoin and crypto move is so out of whack that, I mean, we talked about MiCA a year ago, right? Like, mm-hmm. And it's just now starting to begin its 18 month work in period. I mean, think about where Bitcoin was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you know, and they're just going to get off the ground, and there's countries that aren't even close to prepared for this, but they've seen it coming for 3 years at least. So now I think MiCA is a step in the right direction to give regulatory clarity to companies. And I think it'll attract talent into the Eurozone period. I think I listened to a podcast. I think it was the Pomp podcast. And he had like basically an institution panel that had a Coinbase guy, a VanEck guy, you know, a couple of the ETFs. And one of the guys brought up MiCA and how it's like it's much more friendly to do these electronically traded products in Europe. They can do basically all the stuff that they can normally do with other commodity ETFs, where in the United States it's a little more restricted. But so, you know, when they talked about the US versus when they talked about Europe, you know, there was a lean towards Europe because it's easier to do business, and they've had ETFs longer over there. But you know, I mean, it's not it's not the big market that the U.S. is, but it could be growing faster than the U.S. if they keep this up. So, you know, it's maybe somebody will realize that it's bad for the country to restrict crypto and Bitcoin. So we'll see.
I think a lot of people have to leave office before that happens.
Yeah.
So the other interesting piece that I did see, we've talked about Africa, and I think Cardano has been going after Africa for a while, but South Africa is about to hand out 60 crypto licenses in the next couple of weeks, which is a big deal. I mean, that's kind of exciting. Plus, they have an election in about a month too. So then they're saying the election is not going to interfere with the whole crypto regulation piece that they have going on, which is impressive, right? They have kind of always separated a lot of that stuff, which is much harder to do apparently in other countries, but it does make them as one of the first African nations to actually have some sort of licensing plan for crypto, which is exciting to see, right? It's a good step forward.
Yeah. I mean, every country needs to be making decisions, and if you're not, other countries are, and you're going to end up with another few El Salvadors while you're, you know, I think Russia came out with a Bitcoin ban within the last week. I mean, which side do you want to be on? The one that's supporting an unstoppable force, or the one who thinks they're an immovable object? Right. I would think I would rather just go with Bitcoin. And it's just strange to fight this. I would think AI would be a more fightable technology than Bitcoin and crypto. But I guess they can more clearly see the problems that crypto may bring to the table for bankers. And they can't see some of the problems AI may bring to the table for everything else.
To have control in the government, you have to control the money. And I think what crypto does is it reduces the amount of control you have over money. And that's a problem for everybody in government, right? So I think that's probably the reason that they're waking up to all of this. But I mean, we talked about Russia, right? Another crazy country, it's China that has banned Bitcoin. Yet Hong Kong is about to, I think actually today, is they're releasing Bitcoin and Ethereum spot ETFs. Right.
Yeah. So this is yesterday. I've got the data from the first day of flows and volume.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a huge deal. Now they've taken the lead. I think that there's maybe not as much bullishness because if you're in mainland China, you can't really invest in these yet. So it was going to be probably this huge amount of money that was going to come in from the Chinese trying to get into crypto since they have not been allowed to for quite some time, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah. The numbers were 12.4 million in volume, which the Hong Kong exchange is like 0.6% the size of the US stock market. So, you know, the equivalent is 1.6 billion in volume. And so, you know, that's not bad, but if I was on Twitter, people were talking about this thing being huge and doing billions in inflows. And I was like, the U.S. took forever to get to billions of inflows. And this is going to be way smaller than that. So I didn't understand the bullishness. Here's the thing. It's another thing that's chipped away, right? And once Bitcoin makes progress, it doesn't recede. And so, yes, the Hong Kong ETF's in. Yep, they're going to have to convince the financial institutions that they can invest into Bitcoin, that all the same stuff, you know, that the U.S. has a 3-month lead on because we've been having these conversations already. But it's like, yep, I didn't think that this was going to rock the world, but it's just another thing where it's like, okay, every time there's more adoption, the people in that sector buy Bitcoin at that point, and then they continue to buy more as time goes on. As time goes on, less and less Bitcoin gets mined, you know, after each epoch. So, in the next week, this isn't going to be a big deal. But in the next 8 years, you have another big buyer that's going to be constantly buying, that's going to have less and less supply to draw from. So, you know, it's all to me. If you just look at the money side, if you just look at number go up and Bitcoin price, these things matter, and it's a slow crawl and all that, but you know, you're getting exposure to people that not everybody's going to do any research. Not everybody's going to understand things, but it'll be better than it was. And so, you know, it's each one of these things, you know, that adds up and over time makes a big difference. So, yeah, I don't think people will track the inflows of the Hong Kong exchange like we do every single day on Twitter with the US ETFs, which is just now starting to get really boring for me, which is pretty impressive for like 3 months of trying to look at those inflows every day. But you know, it's not a bad thing. I don't know why people expected it to be 10 times the size of the US ETFs early on. But over time, I mean, they pulled $141 million in assets as to seed the funds. 80%, roughly 80% of that's in Bitcoin and 20% in Ethereum. And so, you know, $100 million is not a lot, but if it's $100 million every week steadily, or 100 or every few days steadily, yeah, now it really does matter, right? So, yeah, I'm not sure why people thought it'd be as huge as it is. I think that eventually people in China will figure out a way to trade Bitcoin via Hong Kong, or at least the wealthiest people. And so, yeah, I just put it on the list of something that's good for Bitcoin, but didn't make the price spike to $500,000. Like there's probably a list of 100 things by now where that's the case.
Well, I think that the reason was mainly in China would have access to these spot ETFs, and they don't. And I think I read somewhere that it's going to take at least 6 months for something like that to change.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, the other piece to all this is Australia now is saying they're going to have some spot ETFs by the end of the year. So that's exciting to see. But you mentioned the US ETFs. I mean, we finally had the streak broken of inflows into BlackRock and Fidelity. So I think it took, 71 days for that to end. So they're not going to set all new records, but they still did pretty freaking impressive for the size that they were compared to what the size of the other ones were.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's like those numbers are going to go up, right? As soon as we see price escalation, people are going to buy it. They're going to buy it through the ETFs. They're going to buy it through spot. Doesn't matter. And then, I mean, until these cycles are broken, I think you got to think the cycles are coming. And I don't think the cycle's over because we just went up and had the halving and now we're kind of chopping around. I feel like it feels pretty normal. It just feels like the price is a little elevated from where it normally is compared to the previous all-time high. So I feel like it's just choppy. I feel like we got a ton of negative things to talk about. I haven't even gotten into Japan and some other things. So, you know, I feel like when the price is down or even down a little, it's real easy to find the news that's bad. Like whenever the price goes down, it's like journalists just start finding reasons to justify the price going down. And there's no natural cycles. There's no, some people just needed to cash out and there's nothing like that. It's like, oh, there's gotta be a reason. And so they just start cranking out all these reasons. So yeah, I think Australian spot ETF, South Africa, this, Europe, that, MiCA. It's like, yeah, man, these are regulations and these are different governments getting involved. At this point, like Russia saying they're banning Bitcoin, I'm like, no, you're not. Like, you're just going to prevent your people from exposing themselves to Bitcoin. And that's a bad thing. So, like, these things don't really bother me. But when the price is down, there's a gazillion negative narratives for Bitcoin.
Yeah, so most of the things that I have talked about, I feel like have been pretty negative. The rest of the stuff, I feel like I do have some positive things to say. So, ending on a positive note. And Franklin Templeton was one of the ETFs that came up. And I mean, they're in a couple hundred million dollars of assets under management. So tiny compared to the BlackRocks of the world. But what they've said is they're just getting started, right? I mean, most of the investment advisors they've been talking to are very close to putting Franklin Templeton ETFs into the options for their advisors to sell. So they're expecting a lot. And then what they did that was really freaking cool, they had their, what is it, U.S. government money funds or whatever they call it, where they put it on, I think it's Matic and Stellar is where it was listed, right? And they have now enabled it to be traded from person to person. So it doesn't have to go through a third party because it's on a public blockchain, right? Which I think they're one of the first ones to allow to do that. So if I had it and I wanted to send it to you, I could do that without having to go through a Franklin Templeton. So that's kind of cool they're doing that, and it's going to make things happen a lot faster. The whole the velocity of money, the more you speed that up, the greater the GDP and the greater the market does overall. So this is exciting to see. We'll just see what actually happens with it and if anybody does anything with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just Franklin Templeton. I mean, I've listened to quite a few, the Bitwise guys, the guys on that Pomp podcast. Morgan Stanley, I think, just came out and said that they're allowing their advisors to recommend the Bitcoin ETFs to clients. And so it's exactly what we talked about. Like, in 3 months, we'll see some stuff. In between 6 to 12 months from the release of the ETFs is when institutions kind of make decisions. Some of them can't even evaluate an ETF until it's been launched for 6 months. And so, you know, again, it's a ratcheting effect. And the ETFs was like click, 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 right? Like it made a huge inroad, and it's going to take a while for these slow institutions to move. So, you know, same thing with Hong Kong. It's the same thing with everything. Same thing with people. You know, the first time I put money into Bitcoin was 2017. And then in 2020 and 2021 is when I put real money into Bitcoin. You know what I mean? And that's me. And I'm on a podcast and, you know, listen to this stuff on a very regular basis. Like an embarrassingly high amount of Bitcoin content goes through my ears. And so, you know, yeah, these other guys, they're still stuck in fiat land, trying to make profit and yield and, you know, all this other stuff. And so, yeah, it's going to take a long time for that to crack. And so, yeah, but if you're into Bitcoin, you're in it for a long time. So it works. So, yeah, I think just let it keep rolling.
Yeah, it's Marathon Digital. I mean, we talked about the halving not too long ago, and everybody's worried about what that was going to do to miners. And they are planning to double their hash rate this year. Right. So they see bright things for the future, right? It's not something that scares them at all. And they're excited about what's to come. So, I mean, it's always positive to hear the miners saying that too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, the more hash rate, the better. And eventually some miners will capitulate and some miners will be successful, but it's good for the network.
Yeah. And then, so there's a handful of really interesting announcements that I saw. I'll start with Stripe, right? So most people have probably used Stripe before or heard of Stripe, but Stripe is actually going to start accepting USDC this summer, right? So not Tether, see, so Circle stablecoin. So it's going to be done, I think, just on the Ethereum, the Solana, and the Matic blockchains right now, but they'll probably try to add other blockchains in the future. But that's exciting, right? I mean, you can theoretically use stablecoins as a payment on Stripe. And what's interesting, Stripe actually had Bitcoin integrations back in 2014. I don't know if you remember or heard about this, but they were one of the first ones to do it in 2014, which Bitcoin wasn't around for very long. And they ended up they stopped it in like 2018 because they were saying the fees on the Bitcoin network were so high. So, I mean, Stripe has been around and been trying to get involved with crypto for a long time, and now they're kind of getting back to it and getting involved with stablecoins, right? Which we said stablecoins make sense from a use case perspective, especially on the Solana and the Matic blockchains where the gas prices are next to nothing compared to Ethereum lately.
Yeah, I mean, it's Stripe. I did not know that in 2014 they were granting access to Bitcoin or using coin through their payment rails to use Bitcoin on the main chain is pretty short-sighted if you're looking at growth on a transaction basis. So that's kind of funny that they were like, oh, the fees are too expensive. Because, you know, Lightning Network and like when you buy Bitcoin on Strike, and that's Strike with a K, not Stripe with a P, you have two choices. You can basically pay no fees, or you can pay a fee and have it done quicker. And what Strike does is they batch process their transactions, and then the net transaction is put on the blockchain once a day, whatever, whenever the fees are low, and then it's divided up among everybody. So there's like it can be cheaper, but you got to trust me. or you can pay the full freight of your fees, and basically they'll just be the conduit to force the transaction into the blockchain. And so, you know, if you're Stripe and you're seeing what Strike is doing, I would think you could be like, yeah, I think there's a way we could get into this and do this in a way that makes sense and gets you all the things that you, that everybody likes about Bitcoin, probably cheaper than what they can do with credit cards. Like, it's, if Strike can do it, I would think you could be able to get that done. And the thing that, the difference being, Stripe is already established. They just need to roll out the technology to their customers. Whereas Strike is a new player and they're having to get new contracts and explain who they are and what they do. So that'd be interesting to watch. You know, integrating Bitcoin into financial transactions, is the more we do it, the better, because it just fights this nefarious use. Bitcoin's a pet rock that's only good. It's good for nothing except for it's good for creating $1 billion worth of terrorism every year. You know, it's just, it's such an insane narrative that won't go away. So the more good things that you do, the better off you are, and it dilutes the $100,000 that Hamas gets from via Bitcoin that just, yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. But yeah, use it. That's what it's there for. Bitcoin is created and set out in the world, and people get to do with it whatever they want.
So I guess real quick, I did want to mention Strike, but the piece that you're talking about with Bitcoin, I think, is when you're sending Bitcoin, where you can choose to pay for a fee now or have it paid for free later. I think Strike is actually just implemented a 1% fee, a fee based on the amount of money that you are spending at a monthly clip. So I think it starts out at like 1% and drops down from there. So it used to be almost, you could get it for free if you chose it whenever you let them buy it. But that seems to have changed from what I've seen. Okay. So
yeah, that's fine. The fact that it changed doesn't change the fact that it worked doing it a different way. Because I wasn't aware that they batch process the transactions until recently. So maybe that wasn't a good thing for them or whatever, but that doesn't mean somebody else can't do it better, or it may work better for them. So yeah, I think, like I said, people should use Bitcoin and then see what happens.
Strike's a great company. They've been in the US since 2020. I think they actually moved their headquarters now to El Salvador. Yeah. They are now expanding into Europe, which is kind of good for them, right? So that's kind of impressive. They've already been in Africa. They've been in Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean. So, they are becoming definitely a player in this space. And it's very simple. Like, it's a competitor to the PayPals and things like that, where you can send your money and it's either cash, whatever country you're in, or Bitcoin, right? And they're doing on Lightning Network. So it's a great company. It's unfortunate now that you have to pay a 1% fee or whatever that fee is, instead of, it used to be almost free, but it's still good.
Yeah.
So we talked about Stripe with a P, not the K too. And one of their competitors is Block, right? The old Square. So I think what they didn't really want to be outdone by Stripe. So one of the things that they have just announced is you can now elect to choose between 1% and 10% of your daily revenues goes directly into Bitcoin. And they also take a 1% fee to do that. But that's pretty cool that you could automatically have this money go into Bitcoin almost without having to do anything. Right?
Yeah. It's like getting part of your paycheck direct deposited into a savings account. Yeah. I think that would be like a no-brainer for companies that retain earnings in Bitcoin, just to automatically put 5% or 10% of revenues into Bitcoin and keep your operating cash where it needs to be. Yeah. If I still had a business that operated like that, that would be, that'd be a pretty, pretty good way to stack sats and dollar cost average and not have to make the decision. Do I want to buy Bitcoin or not? It's like, for me, it's a real one way street. Like, so buying Bitcoin is like, all right, I might not see this money until I, like, it may just be decades before I feel comfortable pulling Bitcoin out to trade it for experiences or whatever. But I don't know. It's tough.
Unless it hits $1 million next year.
Oh yeah. If we have some short term spike, I would trade a little bit of my stack for some psychological advantages and in operating costs and just the experience, like vacations and things like that. Which, speaking of vacations, I booked my flights to El Salvador. I found a tour guide that'll drive us around. And so, little volcano hike, Mayan ruins, little all-inclusive beach, like surf lesson kind of thing, and Bitcoin beach. Spend some money in Bitcoin, which would be neat. I think my kids, after getting some brief lessons on Bitcoin, I think over the next, I mean, I guess we're leaving in 6 weeks or so. I need to step up their Bitcoin knowledge if I'm going to do this. I might as well do it all the way.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear how that goes. So we'll spend a lot of time when you get back, I'm sure, recapping that trip.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty excited. It'd be one thing if it was just me and like me and you went, it'd be a lot easier. We just rent a car, do whatever. But like 6-year-old, 11-year-old wife, like we'll get a tour guide. We'll get somebody to drive us around because it's, yeah, you just don't know, man. It's a small country, different country. I listen to Bitcoin people. They look at things through a Bitcoin lens. It may not be as rosy as it seems, but all the spots, I mean, tourism seems to be picking up big time there. And so I think I've talked about it in other podcasts. Like, I hate rewarding bad behavior and I love rewarding good behavior. And I feel like they're doing some good stuff. So I might as well go down and spend some money.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Well, we talked about Stripe not too long ago and USDC. So Tether, of course, wanted to be involved as well. So they just partnered with Telegram. And now you can send and receive USDT via Telegram for free. So, I mean, that's kind of exciting to see. And just another one of those use cases where now all of a sudden the transfer of dollars around the world is pretty much free. And Telegram has always been very crypto friendly. So they were one of the ones that had the ton coin that they wanted to raise and the SEC kind of shut them down. So now Telegram doesn't have it, but it is open source now. And it's become like a top 10 crypto or something like that. It's crazy. So it went from nothing to huge.
Yeah. But it's not just low cost to transfer. It's access to pretty much everybody that's got a dollar to send. You know, like that. Mm-hmm. Send, if you're in a country that's not dollarized, you can send dollars. You can have access to dollars, but only if you're in that top 5%, 2%, whatever. So, you know, the beauty of these crypto innovations in Bitcoin is it's all the way down, man. If you've got a smartphone, or not even a smartphone, if you've got an old school phone, you can transfer Bitcoin and crypto.
Yeah. So one of the other things that was really intriguing to me, I mean, I pay attention to Cardano, and the founder of Cardano is Charles Hoskins. And he apparently has 6 different companies that he's a part of. And they just had an announcement that he's releasing a game on Gala Games. So we've talked about gaming being a huge theme. Gala is one of the largest guys out there. And it is one of his 6 companies that is part of the IOHG group, whatever, but it's kind of exciting that you're going to see a game coming out of them. First, it's going to be on Gala, which I think is on the Ethereum network, but it wouldn't surprise me if at some point Cardano gets involved with that as well. So that's kind of interesting to see and have fun with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the gaming thing's interesting. I'm kind of curious to see. I mean, I feel like half of the states are now allowing straight up gambling on your phone, and you can bet on if the next pitch is a ball or a strike in a Major League Baseball game. I would think that in the gaming world, you could have crypto tokens that you could trade on an exchange. You know what I'm saying? It's not a big stretch to allow that stuff. So I think I'd be curious to see, you know, if my kid played Fortnite, or if he played a different game, a lot like Fortnite, where you won in crypto, and then he could turn that into real stuff instead of outfits for his character to wear on the screen. You know what I'm saying? Like one of them has a more value than the other. Although these freaking kids really value changing the clothes on the character to your screen. It's crazy. So there's a lot of opportunity for a business to do well, getting integrating crypto and gaming. So I don't know that that's like the most awesome thing for productivity and GDP of the country and stuff like that. But like, you know, video games, nobody's complaining that video games exist. So why not integrate crypto and video games?
That's a huge amount of money right now too.
Huge. So,
and then the last thing that I had that I thought was kind of funny to see, if you remember Janet Yellen back in 2018 doing one of her updates and there was a guy holding a buy Bitcoin sign.
Yes.
Behind that the entire time. So that sign just sold for 16 Bitcoin, about $1 million. So it's just, I mean, it doesn't really mean much, but it's just kind of funny that something like that is happening and the memorabilia from Bitcoin's past is apparently very worthwhile moving forward.
Yeah. I think that sign behind Janet Yellen in that congressional hearing is hilarious. I don't know that it's worth $1 million, but that guy that bought that sign for $1 million will definitely submit 1 million crypto addresses in his 1099 DA on paper to the IRS, right? Like that's what they're up against is freaking lunatic people that are just eyeballs deep into Bitcoin stuff. So yeah, I think, who knows, man, maybe it becomes a collector's item and all that, but yeah, I mean, Bitcoin people are into Bitcoin. Surprise, newsflash. So speaking of Janet Yellen, I think she's going to make a trip to Japan soon because the Japanese yen's falling apart. It's like between 157 and 160 yen to the dollar, which is like historically bad. They've been fighting their currency issues forever with interest rates and yield control and all these other things. So for us, it kind of is interesting because Japan is the largest U.S. bondholder. So what you would normally do here is you would sell the U.S. treasuries to get the U.S. dollars. You take the U.S. dollars, you'd buy the yen to reduce the supply and compete better against the dollar. But you can't do that here because the United States is already struggling with their bond sales. And Janet Yellen's going to be like, yeah, you can't do this. There's also an arbitrage trade on the currency that would trigger. And I think that it begins like a spiral. I think this that happened to the UK and the British pound. And that's how, I'm blanking on the name. He made a ton of money and now he's involved in politics everywhere. So there's an arbitrage trade there that can't happen. They can't raise interest rates because their debt to GDP is already 206%. So if they raise interest rates and then as their bonds come due, they got to buy more bonds at higher rates. They're in the same thing that the U.S. is doing now, which is just in this spiral. Nobody's going to buy those Japanese bonds, so the Bank of Japan's going to have to buy them. So you're just chasing your tail there. Bank of Japan already owns 40% of their debt. So it's like they're kind of out of levers to pull. But we knew Japan was like the canary in the coal mine because they're so much higher on a debt to GDP basis. And they can't just live with higher inflation because their demographics are out of whack because for the last 50 years, they've been below the replacement birth rate. And so their average or their median age is almost 50 years old. And so everybody's on fixed income. And if you let inflation go up and fixed income goes up, then the government's paying out more money that they don't have. So Japan's in trouble, right? I mean, we've seen like, I would off the top of my head say that Turkey would be the next biggest country that had trouble like this. You know, the Venezuelas and Argentinas and Lebanons and African countries, they're not like Turkey and Japan, right? Those are like Japan is even not like Turkey. And so, I mean, if I was Japanese, if I was wealthy, I would have Bitcoin. And if I was struggling to get by, I would have stable coins and I would do my best to defend myself against these kind of idiot monetary policies. And it kind of goes along with this I normally listen to a lot of number stuff. I'm more of a business person. I'm less philosophical. But there was some philosophy guys that wrote a book on Bitcoin, and a lot of the stuff is just wishy-washy soft stuff that it doesn't really register with me. But one of them said, if you weren't you, would you be happy that Bitcoin exists? And so 8.1 billion people on the planet, half of them live under $7 a day. Would you be happy that Bitcoin is there if you just weren't you anymore and you were just some random person drawn out of a hat of 8.1 billion people? I'm like, well, chances of me being in a better position are pretty slim. So I'm more likely to be in a worse position. And, you know, if you're in abject poverty and you don't have electricity, Bitcoin's probably the best chance you have at getting electricity. If you're in kind of that medium range and or you're traveling to another country to do work and send it home, I'd rather Bitcoin be there. And, you know, if you're wealthy, then Bitcoin's another way to grow your wealth and outpace inflation. So yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to be happy that Bitcoin exists, regardless of where you're at. And, you know, some people never see it or hear about it because they're not in a position to be exposed to that. But yeah, I think if I was Japanese, I would be happy that Bitcoin exists, and I would start to be allocating, if I didn't already, allocating into it. And so, you know, Bitcoin's always been like this weird thing that you can buy so that if the economy is going well, the price goes up and it increases your wealth. And if the economy goes bad and the dollar and your currency falls apart, then you're in Bitcoin and you can do better than your currency. You know, it's like a weird hedge in both directions. And I think if you're Japanese, you really need to consider it, even if you're not really a pro Bitcoin person, because, you know, other than land and things like that, what are you going to buy? Gold, but, you know, you can see the gold price going up. So people are doing that, and sovereign wealth funds are doing that for countries. So I think the Japanese stuff is going to be interesting to watch over the next few months. Their chart of their currency value versus the dollar is not good looking. So, and they're kind of out of things to do. So we'll see what happens there. The only thing I have left, or I don't know if you want to mention anything on that Japanese story.
No, I was actually just looking at the chart, and holy cow, it is definitely not a pretty chart at all. What is the, like, I see the last low was probably 2011, something like that. It's 15 years ago.
Can go back to the mid 80s because that's when things got weird for Japan. Like in 1989, their stock market hit an all-time high, and it didn't reach that high again until like 2021. And so you can see their inflation in the 80s where it's pretty rough.
Yeah, I mean, it is, yeah. So, no, that's, oh, here it is. One, yeah, so it's been worse before, but that was 13 years ago. In the past 10 years, it's down really bad. So, yeah, no, we've always known Japan has issues, and we talked about it earlier where you said Biden was going to tax unrealized losses or unrealized gains. And Japan was one of the first ones that kind of came up with that, right? Doing it for cryptocurrency, though. So they wanted to tax all the unrealized gains in cryptocurrency. And that's why I think one of those companies in Japan said they were just going to buy Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And then that would get around the having to pay unrealized gains for crypto, because it's not crypto you're buying. It's you're buying a stock. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
And speaking of buying stock, MicroStrategy earnings came out yesterday, and lots of people were queued into them because this is the first earnings call where they could use the new FASB rules, and it was unknown as to whether or not they would basically be able to show the gains that they have on Bitcoin, because up until now, all the Bitcoin they buy gets valued at the lowest price that it has experienced since they've owned it as an intangible property. And now that the FASB rules, this year is the year where you, if you're a company, you can use the new rules. Next year is when they really go into effect. So a lot of people expected them to use the new rules to just show people and not force advisors and analysts to go through and calculate and figure out what the Bitcoin is worth and how that impacts the bottom line and the stock price and price to earnings and all that. And they chose not to use the new FASB rules. So they're still forcing analysts to go through and figure out what their stash is really worth and what does that mean? And, you know, what is their inflows from the operating business versus all that. So Saylor mentioned that the FASB rules were like right up there with the ETFs as an unlock for Bitcoin price and Bitcoin exposure into corporations. He gets it. He knows what he's doing, and definitely it's a strategic move not to do this. I got to imagine it's really hard for him not to use the new FASB rules and be like, boom, I was right. Look at how good this is. Like, there's no like, okay, here's our earnings. But if you flip to page 74, you'll see our Bitcoin holdings. And if you look at the current price, you can calculate da-da-da-da-da. You know, he'd just be like, it's a line item. Boom, here it is. Look at the bottom line. Look at what we hold. And so for me, I don't know what that strategy is. He did mention that it would be bad for everybody to rush into Bitcoin at once. Like, people kind of have to learn and get themselves into Bitcoin over time. So maybe there's a part of that. But man, I'm so ready to be like fully correct about Bitcoin that there's no way I would be able to not be like, look how good it's doing. look, put it in people's faces. I mean, he's taking more heat and to kind of push off this, I don't know, man, shortcut for an analyst to value his stock. That's got to be pretty tough to do. So yeah, MicroStrategy's earnings call was kind of flat. It was kind of no big deal.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, their stock is down 30-40% in the past month or two, right? So I'm assuming if you would have done it the new way, the stock would have probably shot up. So maybe this is one of those things where if you're looking into buying MicroStrategy stock, now is a good time to do that before everybody else starts figuring out what's really happening, because they own a shit ton of Bitcoin.
It's crazy. And then like they bought another, it was like $7 million, like 125 Bitcoin or something the other day. Like, he's just going to keep buying it. And
yeah.
And if, again, most people aren't doing the work. Like, even stock analysts aren't doing the work to really figure stuff out. Now, it is trading at a premium to its holdings, but it's not crazy. I mean, all these companies are trading at wild premiums. Like, stock market is still up there and close to all time highs, even though everybody seems to be laying off people left and right. So yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, MicroStrategy is rebranding itself as like a Bitcoin development company. Why not get onto a growth market when you can? So I'll be interested to see what happens at MicroStrategy over the next, I mean, every 3 months we get to look and see if they're going to announce on using the new rules or not.
You know, I mean, what I haven't looked at lately is how MicroStrategy is doing compared to the Bitcoin ETFs, but that would be, I know they outperformed them earlier.
It all depends on when you pick the time frame. It's the same thing that gold bugs do with Bitcoin and things like that. It's like, if you pick the exact day where MicroStrategy is doing X or Y, but if you go to like the day that MicroStrategy started buying Bitcoin and announced everything, MicroStrategy is killing everything, killing Bitcoin. Like, it's been huge.
Interesting.
That's all I've got. It's funny because it's like, there was a fairly large amount of not positive news there, and the price is kind of just kicking around in the 60s still, but it's like, I feel super good about it.
Yeah, I kind of agree. Like, we start off where it definitely seems negative, and it's just everybody's kind of fighting against Bitcoin right now, but I don't think they can win. It's now going to take more time. We were talking about how crazy things were happening and how I keep hearing from everybody that the peak's going to happen this year because of how fast Bitcoin was going. And now it's hit a slump, right? And welcome to crypto and Bitcoin, where it doesn't just go all up all the time, right? It comes down. It has bad days, bad weeks, bad months, right?
Yeah, and it can crab walk like this for months, which is going to shock everybody.
Which is actually a good thing, right?
Yep.
So, and it wouldn't surprise. Typically, it takes 6 months after the halving for something to happen, right? So, we got a lot of months left before we start to see any action, or could see some action. No, shoot, we could see it tomorrow too, right? But there's still, from a macro perspective, so many good things happening that I am yet to be convinced otherwise that Bitcoin and crypto is not the answer at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it's so easy to defend Bitcoin against all these attacks. And like, yeah, if Russia's out, they'll probably be back. Like China's, I feel like China's was out and now they're kind of coming back. So, you know, I just don't think you want to bet against Bitcoin.
Nope. I agree. So I did just look up, because the only thing that I somewhat compare MicroStrategy to is Grayscale's GBTC,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the past year, GBTC was up 257%. MicroStrategy was up 271%. So, and Grayscale was trading at a huge discount.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could argue MicroStrategy is at a premium now and Grayscale is not. But yeah, MicroStrategy has outperformed GBTC.
Yep. But so, for each share of MicroStrategy that you bought, you own a greater number of underlying Bitcoin as he's released those bonds to buy more Bitcoin instead of diluting the stock. So the dollar value is one thing, but also you've got the Bitcoin value per share that is worth knowing.
Yeah. And even if you look at a 5-year time frame, MicroStrategy still does well. It does better than GBTC.
Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of interesting. Awesome. Well, this has been fun as always, and I'm glad we kind of ended on some positive notes since we started off a little negative at the beginning, but
it's negative if you're like, not me. It's all this stuff is like, hey, you know what? Yeah. The micro regulation is in play. Like that's a big step because somebody's got to take the lead. It's like El Salvador. It's like Mike Saylor. It's, you know, here's a framework for all these lazy bureaucrats to be like, oh, okay, copy, paste, change the countries to my country. And okay, something like this works. You know, there's too many lazy people and it's a lot easier for somebody to copycat at somebody else than it is for them to think originally.
Yeah. I mean, I think the good news is everything's still moving forward. It's just not happening as quickly. And that's kind of like Michael Saylor just said, right? It's not a bad thing. You don't want everybody to jump into Bitcoin all at once. Because if we had $1 million Bitcoins this year, that's going to create a lot of social unrest too. So
yeah, and the potential for a crash if people pull out of it.
Yeah. I mean, the growing at 150% a year on average is what it needs to continue to do. And that includes the pullbacks, right? So it might do 2, 3, 4x in 1 year and then come back half that the next year.
Yeah.
So more of that needs to continue to happen.
Yeah. And the bigger the players that get into it, the less often that's going to happen. You know, they're going to rebalance, they're going to do all that, and it's going to have a stifling effect. So I think Bitcoin's just doing what Bitcoin does. More people are getting in, less people are getting out.
Concur. Awesome. Well, Hal, great talking with you. We'll talk more soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jason.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.